Good morning, everyone, and welcome. Our first case this morning is case number 093403 and 093684, United States versus Michael Siegel. Mr. Alschuler.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Just about everything that matters in this case has changed since Michael Siegel was tried, then convicted, and since this court affirmed his convictions. The government recognizes that the jury instructions were erroneous under the standard established in Skilling against the United States. These instructions invited the jury to convict Siegel of honest services fraud when he clearly was not guilty of this crime. The government further recognizes that the error in the instructions is plain, and it recognizes that Siegel's mail fraud and RICO convictions must be set aside unless it can show beyond a reasonable doubt that the error in the instructions was harmless, that this error did not influence the jury at all. One fact has never been in dispute in these proceedings. As Siegel's counsel noted in his opening statement to the jury, the single dominant truth about the PFTA, that's the premium fund trust account of the Near North Insurance Brokerage, the single dominant truth about the PFTA is that no Near North customer or a Near North insurance company lost any money. Witness after witness testified that every insurance carrier received all the premiums it was due, and every insurance customer received all the insurance it had purchased. The government's response to this evidence and argument was always the same. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether anyone lost money or property, because we have charged Siegel with fiduciary fraud. Under the Illinois Insurance Code, Siegel was obliged to keep the PFTA fully funded.
What did the word fiduciary mean in that context?
Well, the statute itself used the word that the PFTA was a fiduciary account. I don't know what the word fiduciary means, but the statute, the Illinois statute, used that word. And it imposed various other obligations that it called fiduciary obligations as well. The government's claim was that the Siegel violated state law, that he profited thereby, and he thereby satisfied the Seventh Circuit standard of honest services fraud, a breach of fiduciary duty for personal gain. The district court charged the jury in accordance with the government's position and the pre-Skilling law on which the government relied. Two-thirds of the district court's mail fraud instructions, 18 pages of instructions, were devoted to reciting the duties that the Illinois Insurance Code places on insurance brokers. At the end of its rebuttal, the government told the jury, "We don't have to prove that a victim lost money. We don't have to identify a victim. That's not what this case is about."
Well, that remains true after Skilling, isn't that right? Skilling doesn't affect that line of case law.
Well, yes, you have to find, I think to find pecuniary fraud, you have to find an actual or intended victim. You have to find that Siegel intended at least to defraud some particular victim of money or property. And the government's argument and rebuttal are strewn with statements like this. We don't have to show that anybody lost anything. We don't have to show contemplated harm.
Two different things. Whether the government has to show that someone actually lost money, and here the reason why no one lost money is because he covered the $30 million that the fund was out of trust at the back end of the fraudulent scheme. But that's very different from proving intent to defraud.
Well,
it remains true after Skilling that the
you
government
don't
doesn't have
to prove that anyone actually lost money as long as you prove an intent that someone would lose money.
There's a distinction between those two things.
Enough to prove that there was a risk that somebody might lose money. You have to, and Judge Sykes, it is not correct to say that people would have lost money if Siegel hadn't fully funded the PFTA when he borrowed that $30 million and put that money into the PFTA. There is no reason to think he couldn't have gone on as he had gone on for this entire period with a shortage in the PFTA. He borrowed that money because he thought that people were going to call according to the government, because he thought that people were going to call attention to the deficit in the PFTA, and it was time for him to be proactive and to fix that deficit. There was no, I mean, the NIB was never insolvent. There was never any doubt of its ability to pay all the insurance carriers what they were due, just as it always had. I mean, it chose to solve this problem by borrowing money. It could have solved the problem in any of a number of other ways. It had a number of profitable subsidiaries. It could have sold one of those subsidiaries and funded the PFTA through that sale. Instead, the easiest way to get the money was to use those assets as securities and borrow the money. Businesses do that all the time. It doesn't prove that they are in danger of defaulting on their obligations.
Businesses do that with fiduciary
funds. I'm not suggesting that it was proper to withdraw funds from the PFTA. That was plainly a violation of Illinois insurance law.
Would it be proper for an attorney to use his client trust fund in this way, or would that also be a fraud?
I think that, consider that case. We all learned in law school that attorneys are supposed to segregate the client funds. Suppose that some attorney didn't do that.
And
suppose he put a client fund into his general business account. That would be a breach of his fiduciary duty. It could have led to his conviction for honest services fraud prior to Skilling. But has he stolen the client's property? If the client knows that he has the money, if he pays the client with the money when the client asks for it just because he put the money in the wrong account? I don't think that's
pecuniary fraud. There was a lot more here than just putting the money in the wrong account. Mr. Siegel was using the premium trust fund as his own personal slush fund and to pay general operating expenses, the brokerage, and to make all kinds of exotic investments. And that goes well beyond just putting the money in the wrong account.
Well, that's right. He put it in the operating account. He used it for operating expenses. According to the government, also used it to invest in other businesses.
Is that not sufficient intent to defraud? To steal money from the trust fund for, you know, blatantly improper purposes.
I don't think he stole money. I mean, we've suggested several reasons why that does not amount to a pecuniary fraud. One of them is that it wasn't anybody else's money. The insurance customers had paid that money. They had no further claim to it. They were entitled to get insurance in return, and they did. The carriers weren't entitled to that money until a later date when it became due to the carriers. It wasn't Siegel's money in the sense that he was entitled to do with it what he actually did with it. I agree with that. But if we want to ask whose money was it, it belonged to the Near North insurance brokerage. That's one reason.
Subject to the requirements of trust. It wasn't his money to spend as he wished.
Obligations with respect to that money under Illinois law that he violated. The jury found that he violated those obligations. We don't quarrel with that at all. But even if you want to call it somebody else's money, there are other elements of honest services fraud that are missing. Of pecuniary fraud that are missing. What is a pecuniary fraud? Well, Nader against the United States tells us that decision rejected the expansive concepts of pecuniary fraud in much the same way that Skilling rejected expansive concepts of honest services fraud. The Supreme Court declared that the word defraud in the mail fraud statute has the same meaning this word had at common law. In other words, fraud means what everybody thought it meant before creative prosecutors persuaded some courts to enlarge the concept. He lied. He knew he lied. The lie was material. Somebody believed the lie, and the victim relied on the lie in surrendering his property.
You don't need reliance in a criminal prosecution.
Well, you don't need actual reliance in a mail fraud prosecution, Nader says, because the mail fraud statute punishes schemes to defraud. Punishes uncompleted frauds. And when the fraud hasn't been completed, you don't have to prove reliance. But you still have to have a scheme to commit a common law fraud. and the jury could have failed to find several elements of common law fraud. By the way, we don't contend that the jury was improperly instructed on what the pecuniary fraud requires. The government asserts only one misrepresentation by Siegel. It claims that his annual applications to renew his broker's license falsely certified that the PFTA was in trust. But Siegel's license applications and NNIB's were different. The firm's applications made no mention of PFTA compliance at all. Siegel's individual licenses did declare, "I properly maintain premiums in a premium fund trust account if required by law." But Siegel did not sell insurance as an individual and was not required to maintain a PFTA as an individual. The jury could have found that his license applications did not misrepresent anything.
We already rejected that argument in the first panel opinion.
I don't believe so. All right, if you say so. If the jury could have also failed to find the element of materiality, if Siegel had misrepresented his PFTA compliance, would anybody have cared? Most states don't have PFTA requirements, and insurance carriers nevertheless sell insurance in these states and collect premiums through brokers.
It's a standing requirement of licensure.
It's what?
It's a standing requirement of licensure in this state.
Yes, it is.
And as such, these misrepresentations were necessary for him to keep the scheme going, because he could not have kept the scheme going if his license had been pulled.
Well, in fact, he self-reported to the Illinois Department of Insurance that NNIB did not have a functioning PFTA.
When did that occur?
When did he do that? 2001. What happened? Did they pull his license? No, they said, please fix it. And he worked out a plan to fix it. It was not, you know, the fact that he did not have a PFTA did not cause anyone to pull his license.
Does it actually have to cause the decision maker to take a different decision, but it has to have a tendency to.
We're saying that in a situation in which nobody did pull his license, and in which, so far as we know, no customer withdrew its business, no carrier withdrew its business, we're at least entitled to argue to the jury that this misrepresentation, if it occurred, was not material. The jury could have resolved that issue against the government.
Is there any way to look at, say, for instance, the closing argument in this case, which, as I understand it, was a couple of days long, that the focus of closing argument by the government was on the fraud charges and not on honest services? Is that a fair statement or not?
I don't think that is a fair statement.
I think it was.
You know, we could get into counting some kind of word count. But I don't think that is a fair statement. I think that
honest services was not even mentioned in the rebuttal argument by the government.
It was mentioned again and again. I don't think you don't see the words honest services. You see the words fiduciary fraud.
Yes, well, I go back to what I asked you, what the definition of fiduciary is in this context.
Well, I mean, here is let me quote you from the argument, and we can find, I think, a half dozen statements like this. If there, I don't know that we need to get into counting what how many there were, but the government told the jury, in order to prove a scheme to defraud, the government does not have to prove that the defendant contemplated actual or foreseeable harm to the victims of the scheme. Let me repeat that. The government does not have to prove the defendants contemplated actual or foreseeable harm to the victims of the scheme. The mail and wire fraud statutes can be violated whether or not there is any loss or damage to the victim of the crime or gain to the defendants.
That remains true after Skilling.
Yes, but then they go on to say the deprivation of the right to one's honest services is a type of loss in and of itself. And they are saying contemplate. You don't have to find even contemplated harm or even foreseeable harm. That is not a correct statement of the law after Skilling. You have to find more than contemplated and foreseeable for harm. You have to find intended harm, an intent to deprive somebody of his property through a misrepresentation. And, you know, the jury simply might have resolved that issue against the defendant and still found that he should have been convicted on the basis of the violation of Illinois insurance regulations. Today the government turns its back on the theory it urged the jury to accept. It maintains that the court's instructions and its own argument couldn't have influenced any reasonable juror. After disavowing the need to prove that Siegel contemplated even foreseeable harm, it says there's no doubt that the jury found him guilty of actually defrauding someone of money or property. What the government says must be true beyond a reasonable doubt, in fact, seems extraordinarily implausible. Surely this court cannot find beyond a reasonable doubt that the verdict would have been the same if there hadn't been those 18 pages of instructions on state law, and if the government and the court hadn't repeatedly told the jury that no victim and no contemplated loss was necessary. I'm not sure we should have been having this conversation at all. The government did not suggest harmless error when we first objected to the instructions on appeal under this court's decision in Giovannetti. I believe that the issue has been waived. And finally, a footnote. This court's decision in the United States against Black declares that even if the court rejects every argument I've made this morning, Siegel is still entitled to a redetermination of his sentence. That's because if what the government says is correct, the trial judge sentenced Siegel for both pecuniary fraud and honest services fraud, and the judge might have thought honest services fraud the more serious crime. I don't think the government quarrels with the proposition that Siegel is entitled at least to a redetermination of his sentence. Thank you.
Mr. Bindi.
Good morning, and may it please the court. This court's decision in United States versus Black holds that if no reasonable jury could have acquitted on a pecuniary fraud but still convicted on an honest services theory of fraud, then the instructional error identified in Skilling versus United States is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt and the convictions can stand. That is this case. There are three interwoven fraud schemes charged in the indictment. There is the misuse of the trust cash. There is the hiding of the $370,000 commission to an NNIB subsidiary in a brokerage deal with the CTA that was supposed to be for a flat fee, and there was the writing off of customer credits. All of these constitute a pecuniary fraud, a use of other people's money by Mike Siegel as if it was his own. 100% of this fraud.
Sir, how do you deal with the question of whether there was an intended or actual loss? He apparently thought everybody was going to be fine. He'd make out well, but so would the insurance company, so would the people who had purchased the insurance. He thought he could beat the system.
Well, my answer to that, I think, Your Honor, is that even rich people can be guilty of fraud. The fact that he had...
I think we'd all agree to that.
Pardon me?
I think we'd all agree to that.
But the jury could have decided, could they have not, that he did not intend a loss to anybody, just a gain for himself, and everybody else got what they had bargained for. So we don't have to... We can't prove this guy was guilty of fraud, but we do have to find, the judge says, that because he breached his fiduciary obligation to these people, that we have to find him guilty.
Well, but the jury
instructed... Could the jury have done that?
The jury was also instructed, Your Honor, that the defendant could be found guilty if there was actual loss or intended loss or potential for loss or risk of loss. And that's consistent with this circuit's pattern instruction. So actual or intended loss is not essential as long as there is a risk of loss. And there was certainly a risk of loss here.
Can you substantiate that? I know you mentioned our pattern instruction, but is there case law that says that it's enough to create a situation of potential monetary loss?
Yes, there is. I believe this case is cited in our supplemental brief. It's United States versus Mode, M-O-E-D-E. It's also cited in the notes to the pattern instruction. Okay, the fact that there was a false statement here is a given. Whether or not it was material, the defendant questioned that on the basis that when this all went public, there was no license revocation proceeding. One possible reason for that, if you view the evidence in the light most favorable to the government, is that the fix was in. Because the director of the Illinois Department of Insurance at that time was Nathaniel Schapo, an appointee of Governor Ryan, at the time Governor Ryan. And shortly before Schapo's scheduled meeting with Michael Siegel to discuss the problems with the PFTA, Governor Ryan called Mr. Schapo and said, I know about this meeting. I hope it goes well for Near North and Michael Siegel. And it did. There was also evidence that Mrs. Siegel, who had claimed to be the co-owner of the company, had boasted to company executives that she and Mr. Siegel could do whatever they wanted because they were being protected by the governor. So that's the reason why the license wasn't revoked. Certainly, the misrepresentation was viewed as material by Mike Siegel because he put these wheels in motion when the situation went public. As far as the issue regarding resentencing is concerned, in Black, there was a resentencing because some convictions fell and some stood. In this case, I think they all stand, and so there is no need for a resentencing. I would like to turn now to the government's cross-appeal on the forfeiture question. This case was remanded because proceeds were put back into the enterprise. And this court gave the district court the task of determining whether there was double billing, given the fact that the government was going to forfeit 100% of the enterprise, how much of the proceeds would be captured by enterprise forfeiture. The defendant and the district court seize on the first sentence of a paragraph from this court's first opinion. And that sentence says that what is not clear from the record is how much of the $30 million was poured back into the enterprise and how much went to benefit Siegel personally. And both the district court and the defendant treat that as the operative remand order. But that question, I submit, is antecedent to the second part of that paragraph, because the very next sentence says, without that information, we cannot determine whether at least part of the $30 million forfeiture would constitute double billing. So we submit that the district court erred in ruling that our argument was foreclosed on remand. It's true that proceeds from the fraud went back into the enterprise. That's a given. It's also true, we submit, that they came right back out and in full, because the defendant had to borrow against enterprise assets to meet his premium obligation. Enterprise assets were sold by the trustee, winding down the affairs to pay that $30 million debt. The defendant was personally liable for that debt, but the debt was paid off by the sale of assets of the enterprise, 100% of which was forfeited to the government. In short, Your Honors, we paid that debt. And so for these reasons, we respectfully request that the court affirm the convictions and remand the case for entry of a $30 million proceeds forfeiture judgment. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Alschuler, how much time? You have 3 minutes.
First, for the first time in this proceeding, the government mentions things other than the PFTA charge, the misuse of a commission and the writing off of customer credits. We don't know that the jury found that Siegel did either of those things. They were charged. The only reason we know that they found a misuse of the PFTA is the forfeiture verdict. They were told you don't have to find that all elements of the scheme are proven, and we don't know what elements of the scheme they found. The jury was instructed that potential loss or risk of loss was enough. I don't think they were told that was required for an honest services violation, and the government certainly argued that it was not necessary for an honest services violation. The government says that if you view the evidence in the most favorable light to the government, the fix was in. Well, you can't view the evidence in the light most favorable to the government. The government has to show the error harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. That means you have to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant. We cited United States against Walls on that proposition. The government cited the United States against Mode, which is not cited in its brief. I'll mention a case that's not cited in our brief, but I will send you a 28-J letter on it with your permission, where the Seventh Circuit said, an inquiry into harmlessness is almost the polar opposite of sufficiency of the evidence review, and any suggestion that the evidence should be viewed in the light most favorable to the government would flatly contradict the required inquiry into whether a conviction might rest on an invalid ground. The government says that Black held that resentencing was necessary only because some convictions fell. It did not. Before the court starts talking about whether any convictions must fall, it says, in any event, Black is entitled to be resentenced because the judge might have thought he was convicted of two crimes rather than one, and everybody agrees he's now guilty only of one.